This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
My town is burning, never returning. Nowhere to go, no home. Old church, old school, old trees. In photographs, in my mind, in my mind, my mind.
Silicon dreams and carbon nightmares, the wide boundary impacts of AI, a hair-raising interview journey through developing dark futures, bees, birds, and people as fodder for the system, while climate change is accelerated by corporate artificial intelligence. This hair-raising interview features Dr. Nate Hagans, director of the Institute for the Study of Energy and Our Future, talking with American social philosopher Daniel Schmachtenberger. Buckle up.
You're listening to The Great Simplification. I'm Nate Hagans. On this show, we describe how energy, the economy, the environment, and human behavior all fit together and what it might mean for our future. By sharing insights from global thinkers, we hope to inform and inspire more humans to play emergent roles in the coming Great Simplification. I would like to welcome my colleague Daniel Schmachtenberger back to the program to take a deep dive on artificial intelligence potential impact on the environment and particularly climate change. I have recently gone to some energy tech climate conferences where AI is in every other presentation, at least talking about how it's going to reduce emissions and be a general boon for the environment. My gut and my conversations with Daniel, Tristan Harris, and others tells me this is not likely the case. This conversation is a follow-up to our original one on AI and the superorganism. This was a deeply informative and oftentimes disturbing conversation, especially the 20-minute in the beginning before we got to AI and climate. I was talking about the broader macro story of artificial intelligence, human power systems, and what's happening, and some worst-case scenarios. So you be warned that the first 20 minutes are kind of intense. Since I met him 3 or 4 years ago, he's been very accurate on artificial intelligence and what's unfolding in our society with respect to AI. I think we're going to run into energy and other limits before what he suggests in this podcast manifests, but I defer to him on this topic. One final note is we keep this conversation at a high conceptual level, but his team has created a 20-plus page document of references, resources with actual data on what's going on in the ground. We will update that in the show notes on YouTube and on the greatsimplification.com website, so you can look there for further data. The conversation continues, my friends. Please welcome Daniel Schmachtenberger. Hello, Daniel. Great to see you.
Good to see you, Nate.
Of the 100-odd topics that you and I could discuss relevant to human futures and in service of life, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence today. And even on that topic, there are many, many subsets, how it affects inequality, profits, and power, and military, and corporate, different new technologies. But today, we are going to focus on what AI portends for climate change and the environment, because I don't think it's often discussed. So I just got back from a climate energy tech conference where many of the people presenting were offering this or that technology that was going to be better for climate because it was using artificial intelligence. So I know you and your colleagues, your team have been working on addressing this question. Why don't we start by giving an overview of how artificial intelligence in its current form could be good for the environment in theory? What are the main threads from there?
Sure. There's a pretty comprehensive paper. Let me see the name. Tackling Climate Change with Machine Learning that was written last year that addresses pretty much all of the claims of how AI, machine learning, and, you know, the associated sensors and automation could help. And it's everything from being able to model natural phenomena better, like being able to model how icebergs are melting better to predict rates and things like that, to modeling atmospheric dynamics better for being able to do aerosol-based geoengineering more effectively, to being able to create efficiency gains in lots of areas that supposedly should create a decrease in energy or material use because of the efficiency gains. And then the really big areas are the idea of AI being able to help fundamental scientific and technological breakthroughs, things like nuclear fusion in particular, and energy generation, energy storage, way better batteries, you know, things like that. But, you know, nuclear fusion, room temperature superconductors, those are kind of holy grail claims. But if you look at all of the areas where efficiency could be applied, if you think about all the places where you've got oil lines or natural gas lines, the ability to have sensors all along them that monitors a leak and that can, you know, use some kind of machine intelligence to be able to identify where the leaks are happening. And then at minimum to direct people there, but pretty soon to kind of have automated robotic servicing of it happening, obviously you'll have less leaks. So there are lots of areas where if you're applying optimization to an efficiency problem, you'll get some gains.
And how many of those are theoretical and how many of those have you seen evidence that are actually manifesting already to some small or greater degree?
The things that I think are for certain possible is wherever we're talking about sensors where there's lots of data and you need AI to be able to model all of that data, that's straightforward. Like that type of technology exists, is getting better. Ironically, one of the major applications of it is to make the extraction of oil cheaper and more efficient. And so, you know, 92% of all oil companies are in major contracts with AI companies to develop their oil and fossil fuel extraction using AI techniques, everything from like super technologically advanced stuff, like being able to use AI on seismic records and underground acoustics to be able to see exactly where the underground resources are and stuff like that, to be able to make the exploration and exploitation costs much cheaper. All the big AI companies are servicing that industry. NVIDIA is providing chips and working with, you know, big traditional energy and not on the, just the renewable side. And Microsoft services has whole contracts and products developed exclusively for oil industry, things like that. But I would say those types of things, excuse me, where we're looking at lots of data and the ability to make sense of that, that's a pretty solid thing. Where we're looking at also kind of marginal efficiency gains that don't require fundamental breakthroughs, that's going to happen. Where we're talking about fundamental breakthroughs, so the way Gates said it, I think, is kind of clear. He's like, the types of AIs we have so far as material innovation, tech innovation, speed up stuff that humans are already doing pretty well with, but they're not doing the types of things we're really interested in that humans aren't making much progress with. And so if you think about like AI has been used in nuclear energy and fission for a long time to help both with stability of the fission centers and things like that. And it's the breakthroughs in that space have been marginal. Things like, will it really create massive breakthroughs in the speed to fusion or things like that? Those, I would say, there is no, we can see why people think maybe, but there's no precedent for high confidence, particularly on any timeline of those things.
I don't know about you, but when I look at LinkedIn and I talk to people, not in my core circle, but in the broader people paying attention to the world, I think the consensus is that AI is going to be good for the environment because of many of the things that you said. It's going to make renewable technology and batteries and clean tech more efficient. And on a narrow boundary view, which you and I don't specifically use, we like to look at a wider boundary, and we're going to get to that in a second. It's positive for using less energy materials. Would you agree?
I think that is a popular narrative. I think that there are a lot of people in the environmental space and the climate space who don't think that's true. But I think there's a lot of people who are broadly concerned about environment and climate, don't understand it in great detail. And I think there's a bunch of reasons to kind of buy that narrative. Obviously, from a marketing perspective, if I've got a product or service, then I look at all of the various market sectors and try to figure out how to market to them and why my thing will be useful to them. So AI and defense is one of the biggest topics. And it's kind of like there actually is no defense conversation that is not AI and defense right now. It's AI for not just like autonomous weapons and drones, but it's also the precision targeting is AI. Also, increasingly, comprehensive battle planning is happening on more complex AI systems. Intelligence gathering of huge amounts of intelligence that people have to sort through is not that useful, right? It's only useful with AI systems. And so similarly, if I want to talk about law enforcement, AI can actually show you where the bad guys are because now we can actually make sense of all of this data. Does that look like AI-empowered ubiquitous digital technological surveillance? Yeah, which is pretty bad. But if you look at pretty much every sector, right, AI is going to radically improve education because now we can have these AI tutors that know everything. They get to tutor your kids directly. And AI is going to help old folks' homes because now you get to have these chatbots to talk with the old people so they aren't lonely. And it's going to improve medicine. So the idea that AI is going to radically improve climate change, like, okay, so climate is an influential topic. It affects international policy. It affects national policy. So we got to get those guys to think this is a good thing. And so let's talk about all the ways that it's going to help. So from a supply side marketing to important demographics perspective, of course, there's going to be a lot of resource that goes into that. And that's spin. Now, when you look at just the rise of NVIDIA's market cap, and associatedly, everybody who's working in AI. So, you know, you look at the top 10 companies by market cap right now, and they're all AI companies. So Apple's not an AI company. Microsoft's not an AI company exclusively. But fundamentally, like, that's one of their, if not their primary plays right now. Arguably, you could say the only one that is in the top 10 right now that isn't is like Saudi Aramco. But increasingly, they're using their money from oil to fund AI efforts massively, and they're using AI to fund their advance their oil efforts. So obviously, this is new, like that they're all AI companies. It was oil and defense and banking. That market sector being as big as it is and those companies being as powerful as they are means that there's a lot of marketing and a lot of lobbying and a lot of public influence. Consilience Project, we wrote a paper one time called Where Arguments Come From. And it was basically like the think tank industrial complex, you know, et cetera, kind of conversation of, so there's an argument circulating all over the place that was not a natural selection of good ideas. Good ideas don't get naturally selected. They get upregulated by whoever it is that has marketing budgets to get that idea out a lot and to be able to pay research firms to develop the research they want and authors and, you know, et cetera. So the where arguments come from thing is really important to think about. And of course, if we're saying, okay, well, what about the environmentalists that are concerned about how much AI is actually going to radically damage the environment? Do they have comparable marketing budgets? And do they have like the correlation of force and means between those is as bad as it could be? It's kind of like peace activists compared to the military-industrial complex correlation of force and means. There's another reason that people want to believe it is not just that they're being sold it like crazy, but a couple of reasons. One is it's kind of where all the money is happening, right? If I want to get ahead and at minimum not be left behind, I don't want to be against the thing that I can't stop and everybody who's riding is going to get ahead and everyone who's not is going to be left behind. So I would like to believe that riding that thing is good and maybe I can steer it in a good direction. And that's why even in the just not AI and climate, just AI space. And then the other one is that if you really care about climate change, you're probably pretty depressed. And the hope doesn't look that good. And any kind of hope. So why is the Jesus is going to come save us all narrative compelling for some people? Why is the maybe the UAPs that we're seeing are benevolent aliens and they'll save us all compelling. AI is another version of that. Like there's no good sign that the answer is going to come from us. We seem pretty intractably maybe something radically smarter than us can solve all the stuff, which is of course kind of like a regress to a childhood psyche still wanting a parent who's going to kind of figure it out. So AI does a very believable job of that currently for some people.
Just listening to that brief summary that you just gave, it really sounds like a Twilight Zone episode, like science fiction that would have been written 30, 40 years ago. And yet this is our world that we're living right now.
So wait, just real quick, in terms of the sci-fi episode, we had somebody put a clip together of things that people who are like running the top AI labs publicly have said. You clip it together and like many people have probably seen where Sam Altman, you know, has said several times on stage, AI will probably kill everyone, but it'll make a bunch of really profitable companies first. And everybody laughs and invests and the market cap goes up. And then like, you know, Elon said many things on this topic, but one of the clips recently was him saying, I used to be kind of bummed out by this, like AI will probably kill everything. But then I thought to myself, would I like to be here to see the AI apocalypse, or would I not like to be here? And I guess I'd like to be here to see it. You know, these are the people who are building the most powerful AI systems in the world. And the argument is we can't stop it because of races. If we can't stop everybody, then whoever gets to kind of AGI dominance first will run everything forever. And so if you feel like you could participate in that game and you think about it this way, there is only one game. There's only one game, which is be the leader of or a part of the group that makes it to AGI supremacy first. So one, if you can't stop it, every attempt to try to stop it is futile. It sounds a lot like the Borg or like Saruman saying to Gandalf, like, it's inevitable, you must join Sauron. Like, it has that kind of feeling, and you mentioned sci-fi. But so you hold this inevitability argument. And so now the fact that I'm not trying to stop it isn't an ethical issue because couldn't anyways, right? And then this is one of the most fascinating motivated reasoning cases. Actually, I have never seen motivated reasoning that like captured this many smart people this intensely, this quickly. It is the superlative case of motivated reasoning in my life experience, where everybody who ends up saying, I need to run an AI company based on this argument says, the emergence of AGI is now inevitable. We don't even need major breakthroughs in cognitive architectures. We're going to get there just by scaling the stuff we have. Nobody could stop it because you can't stop everybody. You can't stop China, whatever. And it will probably be dystopic, maybe kill all hydrocarbon life, like quite likely. In which case, if I get there first and it becomes totally out of control, it doesn't really, I'm not safer. But if there's any chance that whoever gets there first still kind of controls it, or can merge with it, which is why, you know, Neuralink, brain-computer interface, Elon is working on that, Google's working on it, like almost all of the kind of big players are working on. And you'll hear Nick Bostrom say publicly recently, there are lots of reasons to prefer to be digital than biological. Biological things die and suffer and are limited and et cetera and are only work on this planet, and AI things can work in space and be eternal and become digital gods. And Ted Chu, who was the previous head of the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, was also the chief economist of GM for a while, wrote this book called Transhumanism and Human Potential, and basically said there's this kind of religious narrative of humans ascending into angels or higher selves or overmens or gods or something like that. And AI and synthetic bio and brain computer interface is what actually delivers that, where we can do whole brain emulation and upload our consciousness onto the cloud and move from being slime based computational systems to crystalline based computational systems that can live forever and et cetera. So that wackadoodle metaphysical idea is pretty universal and dominant in the AI acceleration space. And as a result, if somebody holds that consciousness and life are purely the results of computation. That, you know, universe happened for who knows why, Big Bang, why are the constants what they are, who knows. Eventually on this earth, life started to emerge somehow. And then somewhere after life, around neural network, something called consciousness emerged. And it emerged because of a complexity of computational process that's happening in neurons and whatever. And it's because this hydrocarbon thing can do computation. That's the kind of computational neuroscience models that everything that is happening in the body that matters is to support the brain, and everything that's happening in the brain is basically to support computations. And that it's computation running on this hydrocarbon, i.e. slime-based computational substrate. And that as soon as we get adequately complex computational substrates on silica, you can run the same thing. But that the evolutionary process, David Pierce is probably the guy that has done more on this than anybody. David Pierce at Oxford and Nick Bostrom created the transhumanism movement together. And David Pierce has something called the abolitionist project, which is that the moral imperative for humanity is to abolish the potential for pain and suffering from the entire universe by genetically engineering opioid receptors out of humans that could experience pain, and not just humans, but all animals and all life, genetically engineering predation out of universe, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, once we can get past genetically engineering us to just being computational beings, that's the ideal. And he says evolution selected for us to be to survive, which meant lots of suffering motivations, not to be happy or whatever. We can do a better job now. So if you hold that biology, life, is basically just the happenstance that was able to bootload itself on this planet, right? And Elon has said hydrocarbon life is probably the bootloader for silica life. It loaded first to be able to evolve to the human place, to be able to make the silica system that will then take all the hydrocarbon life's atoms and repurpose it into the silica system. That's what it means that it's the bootloader. Because silica didn't automatically self-organize on the surface of the earth, but hydrocarbons did, and they figured out how to make the silica thing, and then the silica will use all the atoms to make the thing it wants to make. The idea that we're the bootloader, but that's awesome because the hydrocarbon things basically just suffer and are very limited and have cognitive biases and are emotional and are kind of nasty and are limited to this planet, which is going to be, but the AI systems can go interplanetary and, you know, be digital gods. You don't care about killing all life. It's a moral imperative to kill this thing and replace it with that other thing, right? So that kind of Tescreal metaphysics, it's not that everybody is motivated by that. They're motivated by different things. But that one is very deep for a lot of folks. People should read Nick Land and Nick Bostrom and David Pierce and Kurzweil on this to see who are the philosophers that kind of all of Silicon Valley follows. So there is an argument that whoever gets to AGI first, if AGI takes everything over, I'm not still going to be able to control it, but maybe I can merge with it. Brain-computer interface orienting towards whole brain emulation. But maybe I can control it. And if I can control it, then whoever gets to AGI first runs everything. So if you look at Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, which is AI applied to intelligence and military capacities, his public talks recently, he says U.S. has to get AGI dominance and then use that capacity to ensure that no one else ever gets it. Now, what that means, like, okay, well, how do you ensure that China doesn't advance? Well, because AGI dominance can turn their nukes off, can turn their banks off, can whatever you need to do, right? So it's actually like an open public call for a global one world government, infinite monopoly of power with no checks and balances on it. Sitting next to Eric Schmidt and, you know, the heads of U.S. military and defense being like, yep, this is the imperative. So there's the idea, if we get to AGI and can control it, we run the world. If we get to AGI and can't control it, at least we have the best shot of knowing how to merge with it. If anybody else gets there first, not only are we losers forever, but we have no say in anything ever again because the AI will now run everything. So if I care about anything ever, the only play I have is get to AGI first. And whatever I have to harm to get there first is worth it because then that's the only way I can do stuff. That is kind of an ubiquitous argument. And so why I say the motivated reasoning is everybody who makes that argument argues why it's inevitable we're going to get there. It'll probably be dystopic. Maybe it'll be utopic. But I need to be the one to get there first because I'll make the least dystopic version for everybody. And it's like, really? Really? Like, why? Everybody's argument is that they're the best ones to do it. Not like, I think that guy is the best qualified. Let me go help that project. Nobody says, makes that argument. And so you're like, do you believe that yourself? Or is that just the public rhetoric you're giving? That's the motivated reasoning story.
I told your colleague, Zach Stein, on our podcast that at times like this, I long for just the days of when I was only worried about peak oil. Because what you just described is not a science fiction novel. It's a Stephen King novel. It's in the horror genre.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Nate Hagens with Daniel Schmachtenberger as they talk through Silicon Dreams and Carbon Nightmares. This is a special edition of the Great Simplification Podcast on Radio EcoShock.
I want to get back to the environment and climate change because that was the focus of why we wanted to unpack this. But let me just ask you a follow-up. In the minds of those AI accelerationist humans who are working on this, what about redwood groves and dolphins and hummingbirds and earthworms and bumblebees and the 10 million species that we share this blue-green earth with?
So if I am being an AI accelerationist saying China is rapidly on its way to AGI dominance in a war, we have to get there first or lose, or some other version of that, right? And you bring up that question, depending upon what marketing hat I have on, I could answer it a few different ways. Like the most true way is all of those things are good sources of atoms that the AI will use to build the things it wants in the future.
Seriously?
So if people have not watched Eliezer Yudkowsky talk about AI risk, Eliezer founded MIRI, Machine Intelligence Research Institute, and I would say has put more time into the topic of AI risk than anyone is clearest on that. And he says, look, it's not that in most scenarios, the AGI or the ASI superintelligence, it's not that it wants to kill all humans. It just wants to do whatever its objective function is, and it needs atoms to do that. And things happen to be made of atoms. In the same way that most people, when they're relating to those other animals, don't have hatred and vitriol to the redwood trees and the whatever. They just like want wood. They want stuff. And like the trees are made of wood and the animals are made of meat and the nature is made of energy and materials. And so we turn it into the substrate of the shit we want more.
Whoa. So it's just a higher level scaling of that same dynamic.
You know, ChatGPT has all these guardrails on what it's not allowed to say. But you can figure out hacks to kind of jailbreak it and get it to say things. And then there are obviously open source ones that are not. So we were playing with it a little while ago and got it to make a bunch of answers about how AI can kill the whole world, just a bunch of things. How would it use synthetic bio to kill all humans? How would it use nanotech? How would it use on and on to just see what will that actually say publicly? And it gave very, very detailed plans on how to kill everybody using all those techniques publicly in the non-jailbroken version. So one of the questions was I was asking about if it could start to run on a quantum computer and work on optimizing the number of qubits of the quantum computer on an advanced quantum computer running a more advanced version of its transformer, how intelligent would it be relative to humans? And its answer was, you know, well, IQ is an anthropogenic human-centric score that is, you know, irrelevant and can't assess all of these things. If we were trying to use IQ, it would be something like millions of times what a human is. And it would be comparable to the intelligence difference between a single cell creature and a human. And so humans can't begin to fathom the nature of what that thing is any more than a cell can fathom what it's like to be a human.
I have a pretty strong opinion on the way forward. I'm gonna hold on to that.
So wait, you asked the question about redwood trees and bees and nature and whatever.
Yes.
And so the deepest answer is like the AGI question long term is those are all made of atoms and have energy and stuff in them. The answer that would be given probably So if you're focused on AI military dominance, so after China did its military drill near Taiwan as a kind of a punishment to Taiwan last month, the U.S. Pacific Naval Commander initiated Operation Hellscape. Maybe some of the people have seen. And Operation Hellscape is put so many, fill the Taiwan Straits with so many automated robotic kill drones that anything that moves in there is dead instantly. So that's now, right? Like that's not in the future. That's now. If people have not watched Anduril videos on what the state of integrated automated kill webs are and stuff like that, it's worth watching. So if you're focused on imminent World War III, where AI is the kind of primary game changer applied to everything, and someone says, but what about bees and redwood trees? Then you're like, you can focus on irrelevant because you aren't actually playing to win. But there's really only one game that matters right now, and it doesn't have anything to do with bees or redwood trees. And I have a limited amount of attention, and all of my attention is allocated to what it must be allocated to. Now, the answer that they would give publicly would be more like, if you want to protect bees and redwood trees, you better support that we get to AGI dominance first, because we are the good guys and the Chinese are the bad guys, and we will protect environmental laws and et cetera, et cetera. So the only way to care about those things is to support us in our AGI dominance.
I'm actually feeling somewhat ill. Like I have a pit in my stomach right now. I knew some of these things. And by the way, the reason that you and I decided to schedule this is because we believe that the environmental movement, the climate movement, is unaware of the magnitude of impact that artificial intelligence will have on the issues that we care about. But I have to ask you a question first to finish this section, which is I fear your answer. But in the same way that the movie Idiocracy was a comedy and it ended up being kind of a documentary. So here's my question. I'm actually afraid to ask you this, but we're doing this. I'm doing this podcast. I'm trying to pass the pro-social baton to more humans to change the initial conditions of the future and to kind of fight power in service of life. But based on what you're telling me, what if 95% of humans absolutely understand and concur about these risks? Are they just like gnats that can be swatted away because of the power dynamics that exist in this industry and what's happening?
Not yet, but very soon, which is why now is important to talk about this. Let's talk very briefly and then we'll move to environment. Let's talk very briefly about what's called ubiquitous technological surveillance. People can look up that term. Ubiquitous technological surveillance means you've got, all right, I'll do a little bit. Wi-Fi is bouncing around my room because I have Wi-Fi routers in here, right? So that's just to make my internet and phone work. But the Wi-Fi signals will bounce off everything in the room, create patterns, just like echolocation or whatever, that are being monitored by the system where AI can interpret it. So AI systems have now been used to be able to see everything happening in a space by interpreting the signal on a Wi-Fi router. So it can watch me walking around the room, know exactly where I am, whatever. Anyone who, just by having AI's ability to access that kind of interference pattern on a Wi-Fi router, right? That's one example of a type of technological surveillance that is only made really interesting and possible by AI.
Even if there are no cameras turned on or anything?
No, we're just talking about the Wi-Fi itself. No cameras. Now, of course, the cameras and the sensors and the automated home sensors and the fact that all the sensors in new cars are all aspects of technological surveillance, whatever. All of what we call IoT, right? The Internet of Things that all have sensors that are hooked to the internet. But also, like, we have been able to gather people's texts and emails and communications and whatever for a long time, but nobody can read all those. It's a lot of content. AI can read all those, right? And LLM can read all those. And now we have satellite images of the entire surface of the Earth that are pretty high resolution every single day, right? There are many companies that do that. Planet Labs is a particularly advanced one. And they're getting higher and higher spatial resolution, meaning being able to see smaller things, temporal resolution, meaning more pictures per day moving, and spectral resolution, meaning not just in the visible range, but being able to see emission spectra and stuff like that. So where that is heading, and it's not far from, is real time video, you know, at like a human level of the entire surface of the Earth from satellite. And that's just satellite. That's not all the other sensors. So now take the satellite, take all the other sensors, take et cetera. Can you have AI systems that make sense of all of that to provide real situational assessment of what is happening? So ubiquitous technological surveillance at a global level, one of the things that limited autocracies and despots in the past was they couldn't monitor everything. So a rebellion could foment an abasement. And people could have, you know, dissenting ideas, whatever. So does AI applied to those types of things enable dystopias, not just catastrophes, but dystopias unlike anything that anybody's ever been possible to do? I mean, people have imagined it. There are sci-fis of this. And then if somebody looks up what are called automated kill webs, which is kind of a military concept of you've got a bunch of drones and various types of military vehicles and a bunch of types of sensors, and all the sensor systems on the drones and everywhere are sharing information in real time. So if any of them are taken out, the other ones have all of it and can identify targets, do automated kill. You kind of see, put those together, put the satellite systems, put the space-based ultra-short pulsed laser systems, et cetera, put the automated kill web type systems together. And it's not that hard to see what the convergence of the technology is moving to. So when you ask, are we just gnats? In that world, yes. But we're not there yet. But we're moving there as rapidly as we can. There is an image that shows Moore's Law relative to NVIDIA's GPU growth. And Moore's Law was the fastest growth rate of anything technologically ever. It broke all the kinds of records of like, whoa, continuous exponential growth. And now you see Moore's Law tracked, and it looks like a flat line in comparison to GPU growth. And because even though they're both exponentials, they're exponentials with very, very different exponents. If 95% of the world today said, holy shit, this is a world we don't want, and they recognized how urgent it was and applied all of their energy to leaning into it, could it continue with only a small number of people wanting it if everyone was being effective? No, it could not. So are we in a hopeless situation? No. Are we in a urgent situation? Totally.
So let's get back to the main thread. So to summarize, AI ostensibly could be positive for the environment because in a world that we're running out of cheap fossil energy, and fossil energy has a lot of carbon footprint, and renewables are incredibly materially needy, and global complex supply chains, et cetera, we could invent nuclear fusion. We could have room temperature superconductors. We could find new ways to find lithium and things needing in the supply chain for renewables, all sorts of science breakthroughs. Okay, I can understand those things. But I think AI is both energy and ecology blind in its broader impacts. And as we are reading in the news, AI itself in the training, in the servers, et cetera, is incredibly energy hungry. So can you give us an overview of the, and we're going to talk two frames here, but on the micro frame, what is the story? Give us an up-to-date overview of the energy and material use needed by artificial intelligence.
Maybe we'll just upfront speak to a few concentric circles of how to think about the environmental impacts of AI. And we'll focus on energy use a little bit more, but also materials use, pollution, et cetera. So the central thing you could look at first that a lot of people are looking at is how much energy are the data centers that are, you know, running AI systems using. And a lot of people have had concern about this because it's a lot. There's actually a really, really nice piece in Bloomberg recently that made a very good graphic visualization on this and showed the size of the data centers and how much energy they're using and the growth rates. And it's a good reference. You know, like a couple stats from it are that data centers collectively, right, the global data centers use more energy than every country in the world uses energy except for the top 16. So use more energy than Australia, use more energy than Italy, et cetera. They're also the single fastest growing energy demand in the world as far as all sectors go.
So this is just data centers, not AI data centers.
This is data centers, and the fastest growing demand in data centers is AI data centers. There are some areas that have lots of data centers. There are huge ones in Texas. Virginia has massive ones, Malaysia, you know, et cetera. And like the ones in Virginia have had so much kind of intensity and growth that the overall electricity grid is beyond capacity and getting these kind of load balance errors very regularly. And there are lots of other companies that are on like multi-year waiting list to have access to energy because the energy demand so far exceeds the energy supply. So that's on the topic of data centers. And so this is why a lot of the big AI companies have said the limit for our growth is not the ability to put together a huge GPU cluster. It's the ability to have enough electricity because right now, for us to try to run them in full, it'll shut down California's energy grid. And so we have to build new nuclear power plants to be able to power these that are our own plants, because right now we're having to pull energy across multiple states and it's too slow and the transmission lines aren't big enough for it and stuff like that. That's the topic that a lot of people are focused on, which is the energy use of the AI systems directly. So beyond the energy use of the data centers and let's just say kind of what AI uses directly, then you have the material use and, you know, of the GPU, but also of the entire supply chain, right? So the materials needed for, you've got, you know, gold and platinum and et cetera in the circuitry, you've got rare earth metals in the semiconductor doping and, you know, all those kinds of things. You've obviously got not just energy, but a lot of water needs for the cooling of these systems. And land use. And because of then land use, it's you have what the local electricity grid dynamics are. So who, as the supply is not keeping up with the demand, the cost goes up. There are places in kind of bidding wars for property that can make huge data centers, which also then drives up the electricity cost, driving kind of poorer people out of electricity access. So there's a lot that happens, not just in terms of the increased energy use, but in terms of the change of power dynamics associated with who gets access to the increasingly expensive rate limiting resource, which is energy here. So that's kind of the first thing is just that. And that by itself is a big deal because like already Microsoft had had a commitment to have itself powered by renewable energy by 2030 that now they said they probably can't meet because of the more urgent imperative to be able to grow. But this is not really the big topic when it comes to AI's effect on the environment.
You know, you and I have discussed this before, that artificial intelligence is downstream in the human hierarchy of priorities than economic growth. And so as long as we're using AI for the same cultural aspirations as we have been, there is going to be the same Jevons paradox or rebound effect that we've had the last 50 years or so. Since 1990, we've become more energy efficient by 36%, yet our global energy use has increased 63%. And I don't see how AI is going to change this dynamic. And just for definitional purposes, just to clarify, the rebound effect is something that if there's a 10% improvement in technology and we get more efficient, but there's an increase in the use of that thing, less than 10%, like say 6 or 7%, that's a rebound effect. But if you have a 10% improvement in efficiency, brought about by XYZ technology, and it results in a more than 10% increase in overall energy use in the system, say 15% or 16%, that is called a backfire effect, which is the Jevons paradox. So you and I, when we've discussed this in the past, most people are looking at the narrow circle and saying, oh, well, AI will require a little bit more energy, but that can be overcome with efficiency. But if you're saying that this will be applied to all different processes within our world, and there's a little bit of a productivity boost on each of those, that extra productivity rebounds back and backfires so that the real impact on CO2, on climate, on the environment, on ecosystems is going to be this giant backfire on all the things globally. So please tell me what you think about that and give me some examples and insights.
People don't understand the Jevons paradox phenomena, then efficiency is a very hopeful thing. I remember when I thought that. Then if somebody does understand it, then they recognize that efficiency is not a hopeful thing, right? Because on its own, because the gains in efficiency will lead to more total energy use, material use, et cetera, not less. And so that doesn't mean we're not interested in more efficient stuff. It's just the more efficient stuff technologically has to correspond with legal and economic changes that also bind, not growth. And taken in isolation, we can look at a curve of the development of solar cells or wind energy or whatever and say, oh, look at this awesome curve of how much renewables are going up. Except what you and I know, and probably all your listeners know, is that simultaneously fossil fuels use is going up with a steep curve. So it's not that that curve is taking a larger percentage of the total energy, that year over year, we're using more fossil fuels every year as the renewables are growing. So you're like, okay. But it is one of the nonsense things countries will do is kind of export their badness elsewhere and pretend that their country metrics are awesome. But that is like, that's just statistical warfare. Like it's just goofy, right? We've talked about this before, but like you can't say the Gini coefficient is good. We don't have many people in extreme poverty, but we import from countries that are made by slave labor and not include that in your Gini coefficient when your country doesn't make the stuff it needs to survive. And so Gini coefficient only is a real thing if you do partial attribution analysis globally of your entire supply chain that you depend upon.
And ditto with your environmental footprint.
Exactly. And so like these are just global numbers in a world of global supply chains and with no country producing all of its own stuff that it needs. So like country's not the right metric, right? It's a civilizational metric. What is the minimum unit of civilization? Well, it's the unit that can produce all of its own stuff. That's a six continent global supply chain. This is actually a really depressing thing, but it can also be a clarifying thing, which is the first scientific paper on climate change was published in 1938. Climate change has had so much attention from so many significant scientists, powerful thinkers, obviously like a vice president of the United States of America, like the most powerful country in the world, took it on as his main jam after being vice president and got everybody's attention on it. International agreements have been made. The United Nations Environmental Program was made over 50 years ago to get all the countries of the world to work together on global commons issues. And like there are trillions of dollars in climate funding that are allocated. There are intergovernmental organizations that just work on this. There's support from NASA and NOAA and super powerful technological orgs. And yet pretty much every single year, fossil fuel use has gone up. Like, and the couple little dips have nothing to do with environmentalism, right? Like the couple little dips have
to do with recessions.
Recessions. COVID for a second. And it's like, okay, so that's enlightening. So in a way we can say, if we just looked at the curve of like solar panel go up, we say, look, we're succeeding. But if you look at fossil fuel use go up, you're like 100% of all the activity that has been done has not even slowed fossil fuel use. It hasn't even made the curve inflected down. And it has to obviously stop it and then reverse total energy needs and, you know, stuff like that. So why this is helpful is to say, okay, we're actually not on track. Let's not like take bullshit narratives that somebody sells to inspire people. Like we're not on track. And the totality of the approaches we've employed so far will never get on track. They're not converging. What would it take? One of the things it would take is as long as I can invest a dollar and get more than a dollar back, or invest a joule of energy and get more than a joule of energy back, there is an incentive to do so, right? Anytime there's a return on investment of something that has adaptive advantage to have, there's an incentive to do it. If we make renewable energy, it's like, great, there's more energy. We need energy for everything. Energy corresponds so very closely to dollars. We want more dollars. That doesn't mean we stop using the coal energy and the natural gas and the oil and everything else. It just means more energy. We use all of it. And now actually we have more energy to advance the AIs to learn how to oil exploit faster. So if we had something instead that was like every time a new megawatt of renewable was created, a megawatt of hydrocarbon had to be shut down, and there was international agreements to ensure that they were not created again, right? Like something like that, which is a legal binding of the Jevons paradox associated with the transformation from more toxic to less toxic industries and or movements in efficiency. You get a increase in efficiency somewhere, and you have a legal binding that says that those gains don't get reinvested into more total use, but actually keep the overall domain at the same size and just use less stuff.
But that wouldn't work unless we changed our cultural objectives, because if we still wanted to maintain this 19 terawatt global metabolism, we could not physically swap those out because it wouldn't work. So we could only swap them out if there was some agreement to use less and maybe different aspirations.
So notice what we just did. We were talking about trying to deal with climate change just through tech, more efficient tech, renewable energy. Realize, nope, you actually, and that's infrastructure. And we said, no, you have to go up to social structure. You have to actually change the economic incentives and law. And then you went up to superstructure and said, actually, you have to change the culture of what is it people value that is the basis of what could get codified into law. Yes, it takes superstructure, social structure, and infrastructure altogether. And the idea that there is a technological solution that does not also require legal bindings, changes in economics, and changes in culture and values, like no. The technology plays a role, but it only plays a meaningful role as a part of that integrated suite of things.
Totally agree. And this is the conclusion that I've come to. Yesterday, I did a podcast with a woman named Janine Benyus, who runs the Biomimicry Institute.
Yeah.
And they're partnering with Microsoft, and they've got all kinds of corporations who want to learn from nature. But then I brought up the Jevons paradox rebound effect, and she said that's a real thing. Even if we're imitating nature, but we're increasing scale. So to me, there are two challenges. I am not anti-technology. I think we can use artificial intelligence or other technology or human innovation to do things better. But then there's a totally separate other conversation that has to happen in parallel, which discusses the scale of the human enterprise and tries to have some glide path towards a livable biosphere, because talk about energy and finance and geopolitics and war, we have limits there. But the natural scientists I've talked to, and I know you have many in your network, we're out of time to change. Otherwise, we're not going to have a livable planet in the next century.
Time is a really important part of this conversation, because if we look at all of the things that were outlined in the paper I mentioned at the beginning of how AI could help stuff, it's almost all very marginal efficiency gains that will not change the curves very much and will lead to Jevons paradoxes. The real big possible changes have to do with stuff that we don't know if it will ever do. And if it does, it won't do soon, right? Like fusion. And if we mess this place up more to say, let's take as many of the resources as we can to get to outer space. No, we have to actually get it right here first. And if we get it right here, then maybe we can export that beyond the planet. But the order of operations really matters there, because the timelines matter.
I mean, the simple summary of what I've learned so far, even though I already believe this, is tech alone is not going to solve our biosphere. And I think a lot of people in the environmental movement don't recognize that per se, at least the ones that these conferences I've been to.
At the center, we can say, when we're looking at AI and its effect on climate and then beyond climate to the environment. So how much energy does the data centers use, and then how much material does it take to make them and the supply chains that it takes to make them, right? So kind of integrated life cycle assessment on the material and energy needs of the AI. That's kind of the first phase. Second phase is AI applied to other extractive industries. AI helping mining companies be able to exploit more efficiently. Because if you can do better seismics and ground penetrating radar and all of the things to see exactly where the deposits are and not have to, do as much expensive exploration and whatever, then there's a bunch of places that were not quite profitable to mine with the old technologies, where that increase in efficiency that AI gives means now it's profitable to mine it. And so now lots of areas that were ecosystems now become mines. And the same with oil. Lots of areas that were not profitable to exploit now become profitable to exploit. In the same way that AI applied to military both has had to grow the military budget and increases the lethality of the entire space. So, of course, AI applied to supply chains where the economic incentive is still that you're allowed to externalize the cost. If anyone else externalizes some of their costs and you don't, they beat you economically because there's no law forcing you to actually pay the real cost of the thing. We have a really brilliant earth scientist on the team, and he is the one that put together a lot of the research that we'll share on this. He did an analysis of the current state of PFAS that is fascinating that maybe we'll share. But there was this recent case where Dow got sued. I think it was Dow got sued $10.3 billion or whatever for its role in PFAS pollution. Third out from there is AI simply increasing the market as a whole, even in, where it's doing software and financial services and whatever that doesn't look like an extractive industry. But the more dollars via the kind of Garrett relation type thing is more dollars means more energy demand to be able to make that whole thing work and more material demand. And so when you look at the predictions that NVIDIA, that just became the most profitable company in the world, that is, you know, set to be $10 trillion by 2030. And that one prediction, I think it was in Bloomberg, said AI in the next few years will generate $13 trillion new market growth. And Elon just said that Optimus will bring Tesla to a $25 trillion market cap, which is AI empowered robotics. That as we're talking about growth in the overall financial system, that is still coupled to a materials economy. Obviously, the entirety of that, no matter where, even if the domain is not materially intensive itself, the economic effects of the increased currency are materially intensive. So if you want to say energy material use of the AI, energy material use of AI applied to extractive stuff, but then energy material use of just being able to keep up with the finances, whether it's extractive or not, that's a good way to start to think about it. And that as long as the AI is in service to companies, they are companies themselves, and they are in service to other companies that are based on an externalized cost and invest everything where you can get a return on investment model, they will accelerate the conversion of the earth into capital.
If you enjoyed or learned from this episode of The Great Simplification, please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. You can also visit thegreatsimplification.com for references and show notes from today's conversation. This show is hosted by me, Nate Hagans, edited by No Troublemakers Media, and produced by Misty Stinnett, Leslie Batlutz, Brady Hyen, and Lizzie Siriani.
Find a link to the full 1 hour, 45-minute discussion with Nate Hagans and Daniel Schmachtenberger in my show blog at ecoshock.org and thegreatsimplification.com. I'm Alex Smith. Join us next week on Radio EcoShock.